Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is April the 3rd, and we are at long last restarting our class in redemption in Parsha Shmos. And we have two classes, and then we'll take another break. But we're not really taking a break, because when we break, it's for Pesach, and our Pesach Seders, we're going to be doing exactly what we're doing here. Okay, we're on page 300, Pasuk of Gimel, verse 23. Vayhi vayamim harabim hahem, and it was in those many days. Vayamas melech Mitzrayim, and the king of Egypt died. And the Jews groaned from the work. Vayizaku, and they cried out. Vatal shava sam el ho'elokim amin ho'avoda, and their cries went up to Hashem from the work. Vayishma elokim es na'akasam, and God heard their cries. Vayizkor elokim es briso, and God remembered His covenant. As Abraham, as Yitzchak, as Yaakov, with Abraham, with Yitzchak, and with Yaakov. Vayara Elohim es Bnei Yisrael, and God saw the Bnei Yisrael. Vayeda Elohim, and God knew. These three psukim, these three verses, need a great deal of explanation. Let's ask a bunch of questions, but I think the questions are pretty self-evident. The first question is that, what does the death of the king of Egypt have to do with the story? It wasn't those many days. What does it mean? First of all, which many days? Which days are we talking about? And the king of Egypt died, and the Jews groaned from the work. So what does the death of the king of Egypt have to do with the Jews groaning from the work? And then the Torah has various words for crying out. Vayizaku, they cried out. Vatal shav asam, their cries went up to God. Vayishma elokim es na'akasam, God heard their cries. Three different words, which essentially mean to cry out. Vayizaku, shav asam, and na'akasam. They try over here in the English to not use the same word. So they say, cried out, their outcry, and their moaning. But it all means the same thing, various forms of crying out. So, obviously, since the Torah uses different words, there are subtle differences between the words, but it still seems to be somewhat redundant over and over again, this the Jews crying out from the work. Then it says, the cries went up to Hashem, God heard their cries, He remembered His covenant, He saw and He knew. So, what do all those things mean? It sounds like there were many steps here for Hashem. That the cries went up to Him, He heard, He remembered, He saw, and He knew. It's a lot of verbs associated with Hashem, where we know that all these verbs anyway are not literal, since Hashem doesn't have a body, He doesn't have ears, He doesn't remember things because He never forgets things, He doesn't have eyes, He saw. I mean, all these things are describing Hashem in human terms, which is common for the Chumash, but still, what is the Chumash bringing out with all of these various descriptions of what Hashem did? Yeah.
I also noticed, you keep saying Hashem, but that's not the word that it uses here.
Okay, good. The name used is Elohim. Very, very, an accurate observation, very important observation. We are not going to read it just yet, but the next chapter goes right into the burning bush. This is a prelude to Moshe and the burning bush. And of course, the burning bush is the prelude to Moshe being sent back to Egypt to redeem the Jews. So these three psukim, this small paragraph here, triggers the burning bush, the episode of the burning bush. The burning bush is an episode that happens with Moshe and Moshe alone. The Jews are not there. Yet, these three psukim, which trigger the episode of the burning bush, have nothing to do with Moshe. They have to do with the Jews as a people and Hashem. So let's first follow up on Dina's observation that the name here used is Elohim. Let's hold the place here on page 300. Let's go back to the beginning of Sefer Shmos, where we began redemption, back on page 292. So a few pages ago. From the beginning of this book, the name of Hashem does not come up that frequently until here. It does come up, but not that frequently. The first paragraph, where it talks about the Jews coming down to Egypt, does not mention Hashem's name. The second paragraph, starting with Pasuk Ches, verse 8, talks about the slavery, the work. Again, Hashem's name is not mentioned until you get to the story of the midwives. The midwives and Paro, where Paro wants the midwives to kill the baby boys. In Pasuk Yud Zion, verse 17, it says, Vatirena hamayaldos es hoelokim. The midwives feared God. And again, the name there is Elohim. That's the name used. That name is repeated when the next time Hashem is mentioned, which is
verse 20,
right? Where it says, well, even before, yeah, that's right, verse 20 and 21, where it says, Vayetev Elohim lamayaldos, God did good for the midwives, and the next one, it was when the midwives feared God. So again, the name Elohim is used. As we move further into chapter 2, where you have the birth and hiding and discovery of Moshe, Hashem's name is not used. As we move on page 298, with Moshe getting older and going out to his brothers and seeing the vicious beating of his brother by the Egyptian, and then killing the Egyptian, and then seeing the fight between Dasan and Aviram, and Moshe then needing to escape from Egypt, we don't find a mention of God's name. Even though we know that Moshe killed the Egyptian using God's name, but that's not explicitly mentioned in the Torah. And then we come to our story here on page 300, even after Moshe marries Tzipporah and has a son Gershom, Hashem's name is not mentioned. And here on page 300, the three psukim we just read is a liberal use of Hashem's name. Comes up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Every time it is with Elohim. So from the beginning of the book until here, we have only found the name Elohim. In the next chapter, where Moshe has the episode with the burning bush, he comes to the mountain of Elohim, and if you look at Pasuk Beis, verse 2, it says, Vayera Malach Hashem Elov. The name of Elohim changes to the name of Hashem of Yud Ke Vav Ke. We're not ready to fully jump into the difference in how Hashem's name is used, but we'll talk about what it means at this point. But we should all be aware that once we start chapter 2 and we get to the episode of the burning bush, a major focus and theme of the story of the burning bush is what is the name of God. At the burning bush, Moshe and Hashem are going to have an intense conversation. Mm-hmm. One might even call it a negotiation, if that were possible. How can you negotiate with Hashem? To negotiate, you have to have some leverage. It's impossible to negotiate if you have no leverage. But Moshe is almost negotiating with Hashem, as we will see. And in that discussion between him and Hashem, one of the central issues is, what is the name of God? This is a major part of the episode of the burning bush. At this point, before we get to the burning bush, the only name used in this book is Elohim. It will change to Hashem, and then Moshe and Hashem will be discussing what should it be going forward. Now, we know that Elohim, in contrast to Hashem, means Midas Hadin, the name of judgment, of justice. While Hashem, Yudke Vavke, in contrast to Elohim, is God's name of
mercy.
Mercy. We know that, of course, we always prefer the name of Hashem versus Elohim, because Hashem is the name of mercy, and that's what we want, not the name of Elohim, which is Din, which is judgment. When the Jews, when the book starts, the book of Shemot starts, and the Jews are in Egypt, clearly the characteristic, the Midah, that Hashem is displaying is the Midah of Elohim, of justice, of Din, of judgment, because the Jews are in harsh conditions. In order for us to be redeemed, there needs to be a transition from Hashem displaying his Midah of Din, his characteristic of judgment, to Hashem displaying his Midah of Rachamim, of Hashem displaying his characteristic of mercy.
Can't it also work that Hashem's Midah of judgment could be transferred from being judgmental on the Jewish people to judgmental on the Egyptians?
Yeah, that can happen as well. We'll see how that works as well as we move along.
Right.
Okay, but it's going to be a while until we get to that. But that's a good point. But there's got to be some shift in order for there to be a redemption. These three verses are chronicling for us the shift. That's what these three verses are about. These three verses are showing us the shift, even though the only name we find here is Elohim, but these are the prelude to Hashem's name changing from Elohim to Hashem. Now let's understand this for a moment before we go any further. Of course we know that Hashem doesn't change. Hashem is, and because he is perfect, there is no change in Hashem. When we talk about Hashem's name, we know that a name defines the essence of the thing that it is naming. So, although in English this is a table, table is just a conventional word that the people who speak the English language decided should mean this thing that has legs and a flat top and you put things on top of it. But in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh, in the Torah's language, the word for a table is shulchan. And we know that the word shulchan somehow represents the essence of this thing that has legs and a board on top of it and you put things on top of it. Just as with every other name in Lashon HaKodesh, the name defines its essence. When Adam HaRishon, when Adam named the animals, he was defining their essence. He had chachma, he had wisdom, and was able to understand the depth of the essence of each creature, and was able to give it a name, each one of them a name, that reflected and defined what it was. We like to believe that our names, each one of us, also have a name that defines us, each one of us. And we believe as Jews that parents are given a certain siyata d'shmaya, a certain divine help, divine assistance in naming their children, that they give them a name that does define the essence of the child. Even though, of course, first of all, parents are not necessarily prophets. How would they know? And second of all, how do you know by looking at an infant what the essence of the infant is? You don't know. You don't even know what the child's going to look like when they get older, let alone whether they're going to be athletic or not, and whether they'll be geniuses or not, whether they'll be, of course they'll be geniuses, whether they'll be beautiful or not, whether they'll be skilled in interpersonal relationships or not, you have no idea. So, yet, we name our children, and we hope that the names define the essence. We believe that there is a special divine inspiration that a parent gets in naming a child, a boy at his wrist and a girl when she is named at the Torah. And so, the name defines the essence of what it is naming. With Hashem, it is impossible to define his essence because, by definition, a human being who is a created being cannot understand or fathom the essence of the Creator. It is impossible for one who is created to understand the essence of that who, of the one who did the creating. But we do, though, know or understand the ways that Hashem displays or projects himself. Meaning, we don't know his essence. We can't know his essence. But we can know the ways that he chooses to reveal himself, to make himself known. Hashem is always visible. He's always running the show. Sometimes in a more overt way, sometimes in a more covert way. But he's always around. Things are always being run by Hashem. He's pulling the strings. The way that he chooses to do so is a characteristic that he uses. Sometimes he uses the characteristic of rachamim, of mercy. Sometimes he uses the characteristic of din, of judgment. Those are two broad, sweeping characteristics. And there are more subtle ones. There is the characteristic of anger. There's a characteristic of love. There's a characteristic of shalom, of peace. There's various characteristics that Hashem portrays that he chooses to use when he interacts with this world. The names that we give Hashem, we don't really give it to him. He tells us to call him these names. But the names that we have for Hashem each reflect another way that Hashem interacts with the world. Some of those names are more, we would call them core names than others. Some are more reflective of the constant way that Hashem interacts with the world. Some are more reflective of specific instances of when he interacts with the world. Let me give you some examples. We know that of all the names of Hashem, the one that is the most basic, the one that is the name of Hashem, which is always underscoring everything that he does, is the name Shalom, peace. Even though we're allowed to say the word Shalom, even though we don't say Hashem's name, the word Shalom we are allowed to use because it also means peace. So we're allowed to use the word Shalom. There is though a stringency not to use the name Shalom if a person is in the bathroom. Because since it also doubles as a name for Hashem, it is appropriate not to use the word Shalom in the bathroom. You see someone in the bathroom, in a public bathroom, you shouldn't say Shalom Aleichem. Right? It's not an appropriate way to speak in a bathroom. Because of the word Shalom also means Hashem's name. We know that that's the name of Hashem. MS, which means truth, is the Gemara says is the signet of Hashem. Meaning, it's just one step down below Shalom. It also underscores almost everything that Hashem does. And then we have other names that are used at times and not at other times. So Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the one that we don't say, that is a name that connotes mercy. And since that is the standard way that Hashem interacts with the world, that is more a core name than the name Elohim. The name Elohim, which means judgment, is also a name that Hashem uses. Therefore, it connotes a way that Hashem interacts with the world, but it is less core than the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei of Hashem. But it does mean that Hashem sometimes interacts with the world using Elohim, using judgment. And the name Elohim tells us, when it's used in the Chumash, implies some element of judgment.
What about
Shin Dalad Yud? Yeah, so we're going to get to that one later on.
Kesa.
Yeah.
Where do we see Shalom?
The Gemara says it's the name of Hashem.
What?
The Gemara says it's the name of Hashem.
The Gemara says it's a name of Hashem.
Yeah. There are other names.
Could we name children by the name of Hashem?
Yeah, because it also means peace.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are other names, as Mrs. Starkman just mentioned, Shin and then Dalet and then Yod. Shakai is the name of Hashem. Aleph and then a Hey and then a Yod and then a Hey. Ekyeh is also a name of Hashem, which we're going to have later on. These are names. It is going to be a recurring theme with Moshe and Hashem to define the name. Meaning, Hashem, what characteristic are you using? What midah are you using? What measure are you using at this time? How are you interacting with the Jewish people? How are you interacting with the world at large? What is the name that we're going to use? So here, in these three psukim, in these three verses, we are seeing before our eyes the transition from Elohim to Hashem. When you finish these three psukim, we're still in Elohim, we haven't gotten to Hashem yet. But we're moving slowly away from Elohim and towards Hashem. And these three psukim are showing us how it happens. If you want to know, if you feel like, if a person feels, God forbid, that they're living in a situation of Elohim, how do we get that Elohim to change to Hashem? Look at these three psukim. This will tell us how to do it. It's not necessarily all in our hands, but it tells us how it happens. So let's look at them more carefully. Chaf Gimel 23. It wasn't those many days. The Mefarshim and the commentaries explain the many days are the days from the time that Moshe ran away from Paro until this moment where he's in Midian, has married Tzipora, has had a son named Gershom, and we're about to have the episode of the burning bush. Those are the many days. The many days would therefore be something around 60 years. We know the burning bush happens when Moshe is almost 80 years old. He ran away from Egypt when he was already a young adult. Exactly how old, we don't know. He wasn't 10 years old. He was older than that. Exactly, maybe he was 20, maybe he was 18, somewhere in there is when he ran away from, maybe he was 22, somewhere in there is when he ran away from Egypt. So we're talking approximately 60 years. That's the many days. The king of Egypt died. Now the king of Egypt died is actually an interesting point. Which king of Egypt? Which king died? Well, so far we've only had one king mentioned in this book.
Is this the one that knew Yosef?
The one who didn't know Yosef.
It's the one that didn't know Yosef.
Right.
So he's the one.
The one that didn't know Yosef died. The one who didn't know Yosef, who is the one who imposed the slavery on the Jewish people, he died. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You would think it was a good thing.
It's contingent. It's contingent who succeeds.
Okay, depends who succeeds him, right?
It's supposed to be good, but then they're emphasizing the children's groaning.
Okay, so then they groaned from the work. So many of the commentaries say, why were they groaned from the work specifically when the king died? So they answer, the Das Akinim Balayatosis answers this, and many others answer this as well, that as long as the king was alive, the one who had imposed the slavery in the first place, the Jews held out hope. At least the king won't live forever. When he finally dies, then we have a chance of going free, because he's the one who imposed it on us in the first place. So when he dies, perhaps things will be better. He died, and things didn't get better. And therefore the Jews now groan from the work, because now they see this slavery thing isn't going away. They were hoping it was a temporary thing, as long as this despot was in power, okay, we're stuck with him. But hopefully he will die, like all human beings do, and once that happens, then anything can happen. But no, Paro died, and it was business as usual. Jews were still slaves. And so they groaned from the work. And they cried out. Vayizaku, they cried out. And their outcry went up to Hashem from the work. Mm-hmm. And Hashem heard their cries. and he remembered his covenant with Avraham, with Yitzchak, and with Yaakov. What covenant are we talking about?
Bris Milah B'Sarah.
Well, that's only with Avraham.
They're going to be strangers in a strange land.
That's the one with Avraham. And what about Yitzchak and Yaakov? So Hashem in covenants with them as well, saying that your children will end up back in Eretz Yisrael with the land. So he made a covenant with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So Hashem remembered his covenant. Now, as we mentioned before, Hashem never forgets. So what does it mean he remembered his covenant? What does it ever mean when it says Hashem remembered? To remember something means you have to forget something. But Hashem doesn't forget. He can't forget. So what does it mean that he remembered?
By this action of the Jews, he's inspired. He is reminded.
But what do you mean? He always remembers. He can't forget.
Well, he's got the whole world he's thinking about.
That's limiting Hashem. Can't limit Hashem. Hashem is not limited. Hashem has no problem.
That's right. I was thinking it was like an impetus to recall.
But again, you're using the word recall, but he always knows
that's
it.
That's right.
Hashem thought, now is the time.
Okay.
Yeah, he chooses to remember now.
Okay, so the word remember doesn't mean what it means with us. Right. With us, when we remember something, we had forgotten it. Now we remember it. With Hashem, it means that he chooses to act upon it. Of course, he always knew the information, but he chose not to act upon it. Now he chooses to act upon it, which, for a human being, that appears like remembering. You know, it's, if you have a human being who doesn't, a parent promises something to their child, and then they don't do it. And then a month later, the parent says, you know what? I promised you that thing. I want to get it for you now. I'm going to do it now. Well, what does that mean? The parent forgot and remembered a month later. So Hashem never forgets and therefore doesn't have to remember. Mm-hmm. But Hashem acted like a human being who has forgotten and then remembered. So we use the word Vayizkar, he remembered. We are superimposing what it appears like what Hashem was doing as if he were a human being. He's obviously not a human being, but we have no way of describing Hashem other than in human terms, because it's the only terms we understand. So just like we say he stretched out his hand, he doesn't have a hand. He has a strong arm, he doesn't have an arm. But we use terms that we can understand. Here, the word remember is a term that we can understand. He chose to act upon the information, which for a human being would mean he remembered. So Hashem here now remembers the covenant with himself, between himself and Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov. And then it says Hashem saw the Bnei Israel and he knew.
Does it have anything to do with crying and say tears if you want your prayers to be answered?
Okay. So,
tears are the key.
Okay, good. So you have these various forms of crying out. Now it says the Jews cried out from the work. They groaned from the work and they cried out. And their outcry went up to Hashem from the work. These words for crying out, Vayiz'aku, Shav Asam, and Na'akasam, they seem to be in ascending order of intensity. The Jews groaned from the work. A groan is not a cry. A groan is it's just a feeling of futility, but it's a groan is something that a person is keeping to themselves. A person groans when they are feeling burdened, but it's not reaching out to somebody else. It's just expressing their own sense of pain, but it's not calling out. Then it says they called out and they cried out. Crying out is already expressing it to another, but to who? They cried out. It doesn't say they cried out to Hashem. They cried out. Sometimes a person cries out when they're in intense pain, but they're not directing their cry towards anybody. They're just crying out. So the Jews groaned, which is one level, but then it got worse. And they cried out, which is another level. But the crying out wasn't directed at Hashem or anybody else. It was just crying out. Then it says, and their outcry, which is even more intense, went up to Hashem from the work. So this is crucial. The Jews were not praying to Hashem. They were enduring the great suffering. They groaned. They cried out. And then there was a more intense crying out, and this went up to Hashem from the work. Meaning, even though the Jews were not crying out to Hashem, they were only crying out because of how intense the pain was from the work, still it went up to Hashem. It went up to Hashem despite the fact that it was not a prayer. It was simply a crying out of pain. It was from the work. That still went up to Hashem when it became so intense that it was called Shav Asam. Then it went up to Hashem. Then came a third level of intensity of the pain. Vayishma Elokim es Na'akasam. God heard their cries. That's because Na'akasam implies a crying out. That was a prayer. The pain became so intense that wasn't just a groan, and it wasn't just crying out. It wasn't even an intense crying out. It was a crying out to Hashem.
Rabbi, does that mean they were asking for mercy?
Correct.
But Hashem is going to hear whether it's a prayer to him or not.
Correct. Correct. But again, using human terms to describe Hashem, to listen to something connotes that there is some communication. There's something going on from you to me, from me to you. So Hashem listens to their cries. That means their cries which are to him. Later on, you don't have to turn ahead, but later on, in Parshas Chukas, it's a very short passage I'm going to read to you. In Parshas Chukas, when the Jews are ready to cross into Israel, and they come to the land of Edom, which is the land of Esav, and they need to cross through, and so they send a message to Esav, to Edom, to ask them if they could cross through their land.
What's that? That's the portion we just read.
No, Parshas Chukas.
Yeah, that we just read this week in Shul is...
No, you're thinking about Parshas Paro, which is the beginning of Parshas Chukas. This is a different part of Parshas Chukas. You might be thinking about Parshas Chukas, Parshas Paro, which was last week. Okay, but hold off. So when they send the message to Edom and ask to go through, they give a little history of what's been happening. We were in Egypt, we were slaves. So they say, Vanitzak el Hashem, we called out to Hashem. Vayishma koleinu, and you heard our voice. We called out to Hashem. When did it happen? That happened with the beginning, with Pasuk Chav Dal, verse 24. In Pasuk Chav Gimel, verse 23, they did not call out to Hashem. They groaned, they cried, and then even an intense cry, a scream, but it still wasn't to Hashem. But it went up to Hashem. In Chav Dal, in 24, they cried out to Hashem, and Hashem heard their cries. Then, because of that, Hashem remembered His covenant with Himself and Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov. Now we move to an even greater level of cognizance. It wasn't just that Hashem heard their cries. Vayar Elokim es b'nei Yisrael. Hashem saw the Jewish people. Which one is more causes a greater impression? Hearing or seeing? Seeing is believing. Seeing is a more powerful impression than hearing. You know that whenever there is any kind of a description, let's say a news description on television of something that's going on, and there are pictures and there is narration that's going on, you know that as far as public opinion is concerned, the narrative is irrelevant. The pictures are what make the public have an opinion. And the people in the business all know it. They will narrate often in a way that will mollify those who are going to come out looking bad. They'll narrate in a way that will make people feel better. So for instance, if the slant is trying to make the Israel look bad, there will be terrible pictures on the screen showing deliberately misleading the public into thinking that Israel is doing something horrible. While in order to mollify Jews who may be pro-Israel, their narrative will be a lot softer, in the hopes that people who the Jews who are upset will listen to the narrative and say, "Oh, that's okay." But the damage is done because the pictures are what create the public opinion. It's the picture that's much more powerful than what is being said. And so here, this is a greater level of cognizance that he sees the Jewish people. Of course, he always saw the Jewish people. But again, it's using human terms to describe what Hashem is doing, that Hashem is becoming more aware, kivyachol, so to speak. He was always aware. But as if what he did was done by a human being, we would describe it as becoming more aware. And then finally, vayeda Elokim, he knew. He didn't just observe. He didn't just take in information, but he knew it to be true. The Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, that it is not good enough to believe that there is a God. He writes, one has to know that there is a God. It's different. Knowing means I don't have to prove it anymore. It is clear as day. Meaning, I know that there is a cup in front of me. I don't have to prove there's a cup in front of me. I don't believe there's a cup in front of me. I know there's a cup in front of me. I don't believe that we are sitting here in a class together. I know we're sitting in a class together. I don't believe it. You believe something that is not readily obvious, but you believe it. You believe it. I believe that it is right now getting dark outside. I don't know for a fact the window shade is closed. I don't really see outside, but I believe it is because it's 8:15 and I know that sunset is around 8 o'clock, so I believe that it's getting dark outside. But I don't know it for a fact. Perhaps it's lighter than I think it is. I know what's right in front of my face. The Rambam writes, it's not good enough to believe in God. You got to know that there's a God. Knowing connotes an even greater cognizance than hearing or seeing. It's to know. Hashem goes from the cries coming up to him, to hearing the cries, to remembering the covenant, to seeing the people, to knowing. And now we are primed to move from Elohim to Hashem with each successive step.
So what happened that we didn't cry out to Hashem? Did we forget? You know, during all those years from when we were in, what is it, Gershon?
60 years of slavery can break a person, can break a people.
Sure.
Right?
So is that what happened to us?
They became, you can get used to anything. 60
we
years
weren't
of,
praying to Hashem in those days?
Apparently, it doesn't mean that they never prayed.
Right.
But it means that the Jews were not yearning. They weren't yearning to get out.
But didn't it, Rabbi, when it started out, it was a mild type.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but at this point, it's already intense.
But
yeah.
It's at the end.
Yeah, but after 30 years, it was already intense. This is still 60 years of intense slavery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But still, although it was intense slavery, they weren't yearning to go back to Hashem. They weren't yearning to go to receive the Torah. They weren't pining for it. And that is what was necessary to move the name of Hashem from Elohim to Hashem. For the Jews to intensely want to leave Egypt. Not leaving Egypt didn't mean to go to the Caribbean. Leaving Egypt meant to serve Hashem. To leave Egypt, who wouldn't want to leave? Any slave wants to leave slavery. But that's not the same thing as wanting to go serve Hashem. They weren't yearning for it. And Hashem caused them to yearn for it by making the slavery worse. Since it was now time for the Jews to leave, Hashem wanted to take us out. But we weren't yearning for it enough. And so the slavery became more intense. And when it became more intense, that is what made the Jews finally call out, Hashem, take us out of here. Get us away from here so we can serve you. We don't want to be serving Egyptians. We want to be serving you. That's what what the process is here that's going on. When things are very bad for the Jewish people, we always look for answers. Why is this happening? Why me? Why us? Why? And the answers are often very elusive. And there's no way we can know for sure. But there are times when the purpose of a tzara, when the purpose of any kind of pain and suffering is to get the person or the people to cry out to Hashem. To get the people to turn to Hashem. Sometimes when a person is leading a life that is blissful, then a person forgets about Hashem. Person is having a good time. They're having a blast. So they forget about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They forget about the relationship with Hashem. Sometimes Hashem will make things a little difficult so that a person will remember, hey, it's not so simple. There's a God running this world, and will turn to Hashem. Yeah?
I'm a little bit confused about the difference between crying out, Hashem, save us, get us out of here, and we want to serve you. There's a big difference between those two.
Because getting out has nothing to do with Hashem. What does getting out have to do with the relationship with Hashem?
But isn't that what the Jews were praying?
They were praying to go to Hashem. Yeah.
Okay, so in the time of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, Hashem was talking to them. They had a direct relationship, you know, whether it was through the Malachim or, you know, however. But then once they were in Egypt, there was no dialogue between the Jewish people and Hashem. So Hashem didn't make himself known to them.
Correct.
So it was
just like
difficult for them to remember Hashem from the parents and the grandparents and great-grandparents.
Just like today.
Yes.
We don't have a direct communication with Hashem. It's much harder. It's much harder.
And so I'm thinking, why doesn't Hashem show up?
Yeah. So this was part of the covenant with Avraham, that the people were going to be slaves, and there was going to be a period of time where there would be some separation between Hashem and his descendants.
Oh, did he say separation?
Well, that was the implication of being slaves, and then they would have to call out. In a way, this is earning our position as being the people of Hashem. He can't just hand it to us on a silver platter. We need to earn it. And here, the way they earned it was to call out to Hashem. Yeah.
So, you know, you said before that Hashem saw the people. Normally, seeing is more powerful than hearing. But Hashem did not do anything till he heard our cries, from what you're saying, because
it started with hearing, then it went to seeing. That was a second level. Mm-hmm. It was really a third level. He remembered, then he saw, then he knew. Mm-hmm. Right.
part of the transition is he remembered the bris with the Avos, yeah. Because the salvation from Mitzrayim was a lot earlier than 210 years.
That's correct.
Rabbi, I'm deviating from the subject, but we're talking about something that in my times, the Holocaust, and the people who seem to have been closer to Hashem in Europe were the ones that were punished, because I lost an aunt and uncle and two nieces. And that bothers me as to why, here in America, you're right, we weren't punished, but the people who were closer to Hashem.
So, let's assume your observation is correct. I can't say for certain that's true. Meaning, of course, there were people who were murdered who were very close to Hashem. But there were people who were murdered who weren't so close to Hashem. You know, 6 million people, you've got a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's true.
So, but let's assume that your observation is correct. We'd never know why a particular person or group of people were targeted. That we don't know. We can't know that, and we certainly don't judge the ones who were murdered. We do know that we as a people were being punished. As a people, no Jew on the face of the earth was not being punished during the Holocaust. Even someone who was not directly affected, because they were already out of Europe and they were, but still, we as a people, it's inescapable that we were punished. So that we can say, but we cannot look at the individuals. Why this individual, why that group of people, why did our parents get out and their parents didn't? That's something which we don't know. That's something which we can't know. But you're right, that on that, when you get down to that level, we're not prophets, and we couldn't know the answer to that.
Does the word sha'avasa mean prayer?
They're crying out.
Oh, it doesn't mean... I thought I read somewhere that...
All words for crying out can also mean prayer.
Yeah.
If they're used properly.
Okay.
Right? But they don't have to mean prayer.
Oh, all right.
Why does it say Vayeda Hashem? It seems redundant. Hashem knows everything. So what is it emphasizing here, Vayeda? What did Hashem know?
Okay, so is
Hashem that... Hashem must have known something that people normally don't know.
Well, so we're going to get to that in a moment. But what we're saying right now is that he knew, meaning he knew it. He didn't just believe it. It was more than, it was a greater level of recognition. So now, before we run out of time, what Mr. Starkman is bringing up, though, is that there are some subtleties here, which, this, what I presented to you just now is the broader picture of these three psukim. But there's still some subtleties. So, for example, Rashi tells us that the death of the king, another way to read it is that the king did not actually die.
It's a different king.
What's that?
Made him a different king.
No.
No, he changed.
He didn't die, but that he got tzaras. He got the skin affliction of tzaras, and as a result of that, see, the Gemara tells us that a mitzora, someone who has tzaras, is chashuv kemes, is considered like they're dead. Mm-hmm. Because since they're quarantined, a person who is cut off from society is as if they're dead. And so here, this king of Egypt got tzaras, and he believed that a remedy for tzaras was to bathe in blood, and he would murder the Jewish children and bathe in their blood. And that's why it says the king of Egypt died, and the Jews groaned. They groaned because he didn't actually die, he contracted this disease, which he decided to murder Jewish children in order to try and remedy his disease. And that's why they groaned. That is, again, a greater intensity of the work. I'm going to get back to this in a moment. Another point that Chazal make, that the sages say, which we mention in the Haggadah, is that Vayeda Elohim, God knew, this is what Mrs. Starkman was pointing out, that God knew implies something that only God would know. That he knew. So what does it mean, he knew? It sounds like he knew and no one else knew. So the Haggadah says, and we will read it, please God, in a couple of weeks, that this is a reference to the fact that the Egyptians caused the men and women, the husbands and wives, to be separated. And so, meaning, not separated, they weren't in the same house, but that they could not be intimate with each other because of the intense pressures and the intense burden of the work. It was physically impossible to be intimate. So that lack of intimacy between husbands and wives is something that is not a public thing. That's a private matter that no one knows about other than the particular couple. And each couple didn't know that other couples were going through the same problem. Every couple had this problem, but no one knew about it because they didn't talk about it with each other. No one would talk about it. It's not a subject that gets discussed in public. Vayeda Elokim, God knew. Hashem knew the personal pain that every couple was suffering in the lack of intimacy. That's Vayeda Elokim. That's what we're going to read that in the Haggadah. You'll see it again at the Pesach Seder in a couple of weeks. Let's end this evening with a question, and we'll suggest an answer as well, which is, why would the king of Egypt get Tsaras? Mm-hmm. So he got Tsaras, and because of that, he murdered the Jewish babies. But why would he get Tsaras? Okay, so Tsaras, we read in this week's Parsha, we read just yesterday, that Tsaras has to do with speaking Lashon Hara. That's one of the reasons a person would get Tsaras. Why would the king of Egypt get Tsaras? So it seems to me, Rashi tells us, why is it that Lashon Hara is linked with Tsaras? Why isn't it linked with, who knows, I don't know.
Measles.
Measles, okay. All right. Yeah, why Tsaras? So Rashi says, because since the way Tsaras is dealt with is that a person is quarantined, they are separated from society, Lashon Hara is the great separator. Lashon Hara causes separation, distance, strife between people. A person can speak Lashon Hara and cause a rift between co-workers, between shul goers, between parents and children, between husbands and wives. Lashon Hara is a terribly poisonous thing, and it can terribly distance people from each other. This person spoke Lashon Hara. Mida keneged mida, measure for measure, that person is quarantined with Tsaras out of the camp. This person separated between people, this person will now be socially cut off from the rest of society. Paro, in keeping the Jews as slaves, was holding the Jews away from Hashem. He was keeping us away from Hashem. He was working us and working us and working us to the point where we couldn't even think about Hashem. As we're going to see later, Paro's response to when the Jews want to think about Hashem is, work them harder. Because the harder you work them, they won't be able to think about religion. They won't be able to think about God. That's what Paro, that's his whole approach. Until now, it wasn't time for the Jews to be redeemed. So even though Paro was separating between the Jews and Hashem, but it was not yet the time for the Jews to be redeemed, so he wasn't overstepping his bounds. But now was time for Hashem to redeem the Jews. The time had come. The burning bush is the prelude to redemption. So it's time to be redeemed. Hashem looks down to the Jewish people. We are his betrothed. Hashem and the Jewish people are a marriage. Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, is a marriage between the Jews and Hashem. Hashem in that mashal, in that parable, Hashem is the male, is the man, and we are the female. And that's what Shir Hashem, what Song of Songs is all about. It's a love song between a man and a woman. It's Hashem and the Jewish people. That's why we read it on Pesach. We read Shir Hashem on Pesach because that's where Hashem took us out of Egypt. He takes his beloved to him. He looks down and he wants to take his beloved, the Jewish people. And they're being held back by Paro. Hashem says, you're keeping a wife away from her husband? You're keeping the Jews away from me? Paro gets Tsaras. Paro getting tsaras, even though it had a terrible side effect with Paro murdering the Jewish children, but the fact that he got tsaras was already a prelude to redemption. Because the fact that he got tsaras means that Hashem decided to take a look at who's keeping my children from me, who's keeping my wife from me, who's keeping my special people away from me. Paro, he gets tsaras.
Is there a connection also between the time of the Pharaoh and Sarah, at the time of the Avram, that he got a plague?
Yeah.
So is there a connection?
No, it's the same thing. That's why in Parshas Lech Lecha, that's the Maisa Avo Simul Abanim. What happens to the ancestors happens to the children. That's why he got Saras there as well. When Paro took Sarah away from Avraham, right. Hashem afflicted Paro with Saras.
Right.
And that's because he was keeping a wife away from her husband. That's correct.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.